Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world, but there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from. A curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Peter Leem, author of the new book Champagne. We'll talk to Peter about champagne, the wine, and the book. We'll pop a bottle of the bubbly for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Peter Leem is an award-winning American wine writer and author of the new book, Champagne, The Essential Guide to the Wines, Producers, and Terroirs of the Iconic Region. He is the author of the online site champagneguide.net, a comprehensive guide to the wines and producers of Champagne. Peter splits his time between New York and is the only English wine writer living in Champagne. Peter is the co-creator of Le Fête de Champagne, a celebration of Champagne, and Sherry Fest, one of the world's largest sherry events. He also co-authored the book Sherry, Manzanilla, and Montilla. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you, Sam.
Peter, we have a lot to cover. There's a lot to cover about Champagne and about your book. So I want to jump into it. But before we get into it, I want our audience to get a little idea about your background. So give us a quick background on your journey in life and Champagne that got you to Current, which is the book that you're out promoting right now, Champagne.
So I've been working with Champagne for over 20 years. I became interested in food and wine as a teenager, traveling in Europe. When I graduated from college, the first job I got was at a wine store in San Francisco. And that really set me on this path of my wine career. It was an extraordinary opportunity and formed a cornerstone of my wine education. But I immediately also started visiting Europe specifically for wine. I was going to Burgundy a lot at the time. That was my first real love in the wine world. But I began visiting Champagne too in 1997, and one of the things that drew me into Champagne was really what was going on the ground. This was this was a time where we were just starting to see the seeds being planted of what we think of as the contemporary Champagne, you know, environment today. In some cases, there was a new generation taking over, you know, with like bringing new ideas. There were people who were dissatisfied with the way that they were farming. You know, dissatisfied with, I guess, you know, how they were working in the vineyards and the cellar, and it was a time too when Champagne was just starting to become influenced by the outside world. You know,
how?
Well, I guess what's funny is that, you know, historically French wine regions are fairly insular. Like, you know, for a Burgundian to go to Bordeaux, I mean, that's like going to another planet. You know,
it's really?
Like, back in the day. You know, today, of course, like winemakers travel, you know, more than we do.
Right.
And they know more people in the wine world than we do. But that wasn't always the case. And so I think that, you know, when you saw this new generation come into a region like Champagne, and, you know, people who had studied elsewhere, you know, who had maybe gone to wine school in you know, California or Australia instead of, you know, just going to the school in Avis, you know, they necessarily bring with them, you know, new ideas.
So this generation left the area to study, see the world.
Oftentimes, yes.
Unlike the past where it was insular, in that sense.
And, yeah, so I worked in the wine trade for quite a while.
What do you mean by wine trade? I know the trade part of the industry, but quickly tell me what you did.
Yeah, I was a retailer. I was a sommelier. I owned a wine bar for a few years in Portland, Oregon. I moved to New York in 2003, and in 2004 I started working for Wine and Spirits magazine. And so I was tasting director there, and I was a senior editor and a critic. But, you know, I had never really intended on being a wine writer. I always envisioned myself, you know, in the wine trade. But
so while you were writing, you thought this is impermanent or not my passion? You liked it. But.
Yeah, you know, I enjoyed my time at Wine and Spirits. And it introduced me, you know, to this, I guess, this whole other side of wine appreciation. You know, being
just
like,
shameless,
on the critical side.
A shameless plug, and we'll get back to it. Josh Green. Mm-hmm. We'll be on December 13th for our annual year-end show.
Oh, excellent.
And Josh is a good guy, and I'm sure he gets a lot of info from you.
No, Josh is a great guy.
All right, so you wrote at Wine and Spirits for a while.
I did.
And you were a tasting director.
I was tasting director.
The tasting person.
I was tasting director at Wine and Spirits, which is a challenging but a rewarding job. But you know, through all this time, I was heavily focused on Champagne and continuing to follow the region very closely, continuing to make, you know, trips every year, you know, in many cases multiple times a year. And at some point, I realized that this wasn't enough. Like what I was really looking for was depth, you know, it was depth of experience, depth of education, depth of knowledge. And I realized that the only way I was going to gain that was to spend more time in the region. Like, you know, going once or twice a year, you know, for a week or two at a time, that's just not enough. And so at the end of 2006, I left New York and moved to Champagne full time, living in the village of Dizy. And so I lived in Champagne for 6 years, full time.
So 2006 to almost 2012,
yeah.
You would travel back and forth, but that was your primary residence.
Of course, yeah.
Wow.
But I spent, you know, the majority of the year in Champagne. In 2009, I started champagneguide.net, you know, as a way, I guess, you know, to really explore the region in depth.
So the inspiration was you were there. There was so much information
to
share.
Yeah,
finally embedded yourself. So let's share the.
Yeah, yeah, and having a platform to, you know, work through my ideas and to, you know, report on things that I found.
Right.
And so in 2011, I left Wine and Spirits, and since then I've been, you know, a full-time independent writer. doing some freelance work, but, you know, focusing on champagneguy.net, writing books. You know, following after 2012, I moved back to New York, but I continued to spend essentially half the year in,
really?
In Champagne. I mean today.
What
I'm in,
was
I'm in
the
Champagne.
Reason you had spent the time and? Oh, in I got France. You just wanted to get back, and
I was homesick. Really,
you were homesick. That's, I mean, that's what I was frank. Looking for. Right, knowing you'd I go mean, back.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I.
So, what year was that?
That was the end of 2012 that I came back to New York.
But and you eventually went back.
Well, I mean, yeah. So today, really, I split time between Champagne and New York City. I own a house in Epernay. And so I'm in Champagne literally every other month. So you know it's a nice change of pace you know on both sides.
So there's one blank you have to fill in for me. What was the point? When was the point? Or what was your compulsion? Or when did you decide it's Champagne? I mean, was it tasting something? Was it the first visit you were overtaken? I mean, you made a big leap to just Champagne, and you're the guy, but I'm still that moment where it became Champagne and not looking back.
Well, I think that, I mean, there are multiple answers to that. One, Champagne is delicious, so it's, you know, there are certainly worse things
today.
But you know, my interest was always very academic from the beginning. As a wine writer, I mean, especially in this time period, like you know, in the early 2000s, a lot of wine regions had been heavily explored. Right, there was a lot of literature written about a lot of different wine regions. And a lot of good books written, a lot of good articles written, a lot of you know, people you know, working really hard. There wasn't so much in Champagne, and what was being written in Champagne was often not quite current. And so, you know, like I said, what I was seeing, you know, happening on the ground in Champagne was very different than what I was reading in books, because it was. You know, I mean, this was new. This was a region that was rapidly changing, and so intellectually, that became very interesting to explore. And because I was experiencing that firsthand, you know, it became uncharted territory.
Right.
And that's very unusual in the wine world. I mean, you have emerging regions, but to have a region that's so famous and so old as Champagne, and to have this kind of energy of an emerging wine region, that's very unusual, and
with no great coverage, or whatever,
And so that was something that I really wanted to document.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I don't think we're gonna have enough time to talk about the history of Champagne.
It's long.
And I want to sell books, and I encourage people to look out and buy Peter's book, and you'll get a really good dose of the history of Champagne. What I want to key in on is two areas, and that's transformation and terroir. And I think you alluded to transformation already.
Mm-hmm.
And terroir is a very strong theme throughout the book, which I want to talk about. So my first question is, Champagne has gone through a very dramatic transformation in the very recent, you know, past. You could tell me how many years, 15, 20, 25. What is that transformation? You talked about it a little with growers and all that, but tie it together for me.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, I think that to put it very simply, we are finally treating Champagne as a real wine. That's us as consumers. But then also the producers themselves. It's coming from both sides. And this manifests itself in many different ways. So you know, the thing is that when you talk about contemporary Champagne, you know, oftentimes people will talk about grower Champagnes, you know, the rise of growers. Or, you know, people will talk about viticulture. So like the rise of organic champagnes, biodynamic champagnes, or just champagnes that are more sustainably grown,
right.
more responsibly grown.
Go back and tell people what grower champagne is, a quick definition.
So historically, growers have grown grapes, and négociants, or champagne houses, have made and have bottled and marketed the wine. Just you know, very simply. This is a model that continues to exist, and it's a model that has worked very well in Champagne, but at certain points in history there were circumstances that caused growers to start producing their own wines from grapes that they grew themselves. So today, when we talk about grower Champagne or estate bottled Champagne, we're really referring to champagnes that are being made by the same person who grew the grapes and being made entirely from estate grapes.
Right. So it's an estate grown.
Yeah.
So that's what the grower is. Because on the flip side, there are large champagne houses which
who may have vines, who in most cases own vines themselves, right. but who also purchase grapes, purchase grapes or purchase wines from other people.
So that's part of the transformation.
Well,
the grower, and you mentioned viticulture. I want to keep going.
Yeah, we are seeing. I mean, we certainly see more growers. More grower producers today than ever before, and certainly more grower producers in the marketplace, in our marketplace, than ever before. There are other things. There are things like single vineyard champagnes. You know, there are things like low dosage or no dosage champagnes.
Single vineyard.
So most champagne is a blend. Of many things, right? Most champagne is a blend of multiple grape varieties.
Sites.
It's a grapes, blend of multiple sites, a blend of multiple vintages.
Vintages, grapes, right.
Today, more people are starting to break these things down. And so people have always made vintage champagne, right? So champagne that comes from a single year as opposed to a number of years. More and more people, historically, Blanc de Blanc would be made out of a single grape.
Chardonnay.
Today, more people are exploring the idea of what happens if I make 100% Pinot Noir or 100% Pinot Meunier. That's
less common in the past.
Less common in the past.
Okay.
And then also people are starting to say, well, what happens if I make a wine from a single site? If I make it from a single village or a single vineyard within that village, instead of blending, a number of sites together, how does that, it's asking a different set of questions.
Isn't it fair to say those practices existed in regular winemaking? You would designate the vineyard, you would do estate, you would blend.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But that wasn't going on as much as a transformation now, right?
Well, in Champagne, Champagne has historically always been a blended wine. I mean, since before it was a sparkling wine. And there are good reasons for that. One, Champagne is a very marginal climate, so blending different areas is a sort of insurance. Because Champagne is such a cool climate, blending wines often gives you more complexity and more depth in the wines. Certainly blending different vintages together, like that's again a sort of insurance against a marginal climate. Today, blending is still relevant. In Champagne,
right.
the vast majority of champagnes continue to be blended, and they really should be. I think the idea of Champagne going into a Burgundian model is fanciful,
right?
And not necessarily it wouldn't necessarily make the best wines, but there are certain sites in Champagne and certain producers who are exploring single vineyard sites, that are very exciting. And that do have the potential for making great wine,
right?
And that's exciting to see. But I think that all of these things, all of these things that we perceive as new, these all relate back to the idea of Champagne as a real wine. Historically, Champagne has been marketed more by brand than anything else, right? And
brand Champagne, the brand,
no,
not the brand of Champagne or
individual brands within Champagne.
Right.
Right. So, so you buy Moët & Chandon or you buy Tattinger or you buy Krug or whatever,
Right.
You're not really asking where that comes from, other than the region of Champagne.
Less with Champagne than even other wines.
Which historically in France and in Europe in general, wine was always sold by place, right? So, in the old days, you would go into a French bistro and you would see on the wine list, you would see like Gervais Chambertin and right. Chabot Musigny, and you'd see like Pruy and Moulin Avant, and
right.
and you don't see the name of the producer, you just see the name of the place.
Right.
But then you look down at the Champagne section and it says Moët and Chandon.
Right. Yeah.
It was always quite unusual, for France.
So two things. The first is, why do people not think of Champagne as a wine? I mean, because of the way it's been branded and marketed?
Yes, I think so. I think that, when you read, so the body of Champagne literature historically is quite large. And when you read, things from the 19th century and the early 20th century, the attitudes were quite different, in fact. The idea of site, or the idea of individual terroirs within the Champagne region, was always much more prevalent. And I mean, terroir is important even in a blend. Even though Champagne was a predominantly blended wine, individual sites were still important, right? You can only make a good blend out of good components,
right?
And so people, people recognize the importance of individual terroirs. After about the 1960s, then you see attitudes, or I guess you see the marketing of Champagne change quite significantly, to where it's really brand oriented. Production numbers go up, so of course, when you have millions of more bottles to sell, then
so who had the most product, the most money to market, the most aggressive?
Yeah,
and that played a big part after the 60s.
I think
that started escalating.
I think so,
and that forced brand recognition, not Champagne.
Yeah, and in fact, this did really good things for Champagne as a whole. Right, it turned Champagne into a worldwide phenomenon. Right, it's a winemaker's dream, right, to make a product that's automatically associated with celebration. this is money in the bank.
That sort of answered my question. That's why people don't think of it as a wine.
Sure.
They think of it as a celebratory drink.
I think that the way that Champagne was marketed detracted from its qualities as a wine, or maybe pushed that into the background. Not that people weren't making good wines, but it pushed that dialogue into the background. And on the consumer side, it made people forget about Champagne's qualities as a wine. As a young retailer, I remember having clients who didn't even realize that Champagne was a wine, that didn't even realize that Champagne was made from grapes like any other wine.
The thought never went into that. You just had one illusion of it, and that was it.
Yeah.
So, I guess if you and I could go back in time and started a consortium and a little agency and marketed Champagne as a wine and a beverage, we could have changed the whole landscape. I don't know if people would have bought in, but they didn't have that vision as an area, right?
I mean, everything is a product of the times, and what's going on now in Champagne is also a product of the times. It reflects larger issues and larger, like currents of thought that run through the entire wine world.
Right.
It's nothing exists in a vacuum, and Champagne certainly was not the only region in Europe to embrace industrial farming and industrial winemaking.
Right.
I mean, that was a problem everywhere.
Yeah.
And that was just a product of the time.
Not so much in the Loire, but
All
right, so let's talk about the book a little. The book came out about a month and a half ago?
Yeah, beginning of October.
Beginning of October. It is a gorgeous box set.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful, I guess you could say, a tabletop book. It's boxed. There's the beautiful book, and then there's a little drawer with maps. Seven maps?
Seven maps, yes.
From the 40s, mm-hmm. Why did you choose those maps? They're still so accurate portrayals?
They are. They are for the most part. These maps are kind of mythical in the region. So, I mean, this goes back to, you know, to the idea of what we were talking about earlier, that that in the past, you know, the vineyards were much more important, or they occupied a more prominent, you know, space in Champagne culture. So in the 40s, there was a publisher, Louis Larmat, who was commissioned by the INAO, the official government body of, you know, of vineyard appellations, to create these maps, these really detailed vineyard maps of all of France's most important wine regions. And so he did, you know, a series of these, so Bordeaux, Burgundy, you know, the Rhone, the Loire, and so one of these was Champagne. And the unusual thing about these maps is that they don't, you know, you can find regional maps of Champagne anywhere, and in, you know, in lots of wine books, but what most people don't realize is that Champagne is broken down into individual parcels, just like other regions are, just right. like Burgundy is,
right.
you know, and each of these parcels have names. You know, each of these, each, you know, each village has hundreds of these different parcels, and so these Larmat maps detail that in a way that no other maps.
And
do.
I'm sure you looked at as many as you could find, right?
Yes. I mean, this information is available to growers from, you know, the official, like, government, you know.
Right.
I mean, but it's not available to us as consumers. Right. And so these maps were very rare. Today they're extremely difficult to find and very expensive when you do find them. And I own an original set, and so I guess, you know, my idea was, because these maps were very useful in my education of Champagne, I wanted to share them with others and really kind of democratize
they're,
them.
They're incredible. I mean, if I opened a French restaurant that skewed towards Champagne on the wine list, I think I'd put all the maps up on the wall.
Yeah,
there beautiful. Was an old restaurant in New York. I think it was Provence. No, not Provence. I forgot the name. He had maps of Paris mm-hmm. and all over France. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you a base question because it'll set up where we're going. But I need you to tell our listeners quickly how Champagne is made. Let's sure. start with the fact that it's a wine, and so, the wine originates as a grape.
Yeah,
quickly. I
mean, that's actually really important. So Champagne is first made as a still white wine. So normally, depending on the size of your production, you know, you can make dozens of these or hundreds of these base wines.
Right.
We call them Vin Clair in the region. So it's a still white wine of relatively low alcohol, let's say 11%, right? And so what's happening today more than in the past is that people are increasingly, like, vinifying different vineyards separately. So not only keeping grape varieties separately and keeping different villages separately, but also different parcels within each village to have a larger palette, you know, so a larger collection of these base wines.
For blending,
yeah. So in the spring, when these wines are done, then the winemaker blends them, you know, tastes through them and assembles a blend.
There's three predominant grapes in Champagne.
There are three primary grapes.
Primary.
Yeah.
Tell me what they are.
They are, one is white, Chardonnay.
Chardonnay.
And two are red, so okay. Pinot Noir and Meunier.
Okay. Yeah, we all know Pinot Noir, yeah. The great Burgundy wine. Just quickly tell me, Meunier is a red wine.
Yeah, Meunier is a member of the Pinot family.
It is.
So you often hear it, you know, called what, Pinot Meunier.
What characteristic?
It tends to be softer? Than Pinot Noir. It tends
okay.
to be rounder, not as structured. Meunier is very useful in Champagne because it's a very hardy grape. So it thrives in climates and soils that Pinot Noir and Chardonnay struggle in.
Okay.
But what we're seeing today is that when Meunier is treated seriously, when it's not just, you know, a workhorse grape, when you treat Meunier seriously, you can make some very, very interesting wines.
There's some 100% Meunier.
Yes.
All right, so those are the grapes. Let's quickly how Champagne is made.
Yeah, so Champagne is blended. You know, and the blend can be according to, you know, I mean, it's different, you know, according to every house,
style,
every,
house
yeah,
style,
every,
right.
every producer. So Champagne acquires its sparkle through a second fermentation that occurs in the bottle. Right. So these base wines are blended, and that blend, this still white wine blend, is put into bottle with a little bit of yeast and a little bit of sugar. The yeast consumes the sugar, and a byproduct of this fermentation is carbon dioxide. But because this is occurring in the bottle, then the carbon dioxide is trapped, and so that's how we get sparkle. Of course, these yeast deposits remain in the bottle. That is also very fundamental to the character of champagne. So the aging of the wine on these dead yeast cells, which are called the lees. So, you know, champagne goes through this lees aging in the bottle.
Silly question, just for people to visualize. Mm-hmm. The bottle is tilted so the lees down to the neck?
Well, no, the bottle is stored horizontally.
Horizontal, okay.
Yes. So the lees need to be taken out before we drink the wine, right? Because we don't want to drink those.
Right.
So when that happens, then there's this elaborate process called riddling, which is where the bottle is tilted and the lees are carefully worked into the neck of the bottle.
The neck. So and riddling then, is where you move the lees, yes. And eventually, go ahead.
And then and then there's a process called disgorgement, which is where the bottle is opened, the lees shoot out, you try not to lose too much wine, and then that wine is replaced by a little bit of extra wine and possibly a dosage, which is a mixture of sugar and wine.
Right.
The dosage is historically very important in champagne. You know, people tend to think of it as an additive, where really... I view it, you know, in my book I talk about dosage being like salt in food. You know, we don't necessarily add salt to make our food salty. We do it to enhance other things that are going on.
At different levels. Some people like a lot, a little.
Sure. And so dosage fulfills a very similar function. It's not necessarily to make a wine sweet. It's to make a wine more harmonious, and it's to bring out other elements in the wine itself.
People look at it as just adding sugar, but you eloquently said it adds to the harmony.
It's
added at different levels.
Well, yes. So
different style of wines and
so
dry.
And it's not just a matter of selecting like, well, you know, I want a sweeter wine, so I'll put more dosage.
Right.
Or I want a drier one, so I'm not gonna put any.
Right.
You have to respect the wine itself. And part of the job of the winemaker is to determine what level of dosage is ideal for that particular wine.
Right.
And the number itself really doesn't matter. I mean, today I think we get hung up on dosage. You know, people think like, oh, this has 7 grams. Like, that sounds like so much. I don't want to drink it.
Irrelevant. But it's a matter of the blend and the wine making and how it complements it and all of that.
Yeah.
All right. So the dosage is added.
Dosage is added, and then the bottle is corked, and
the lees are out.
The lees are out. Yeah.
Some people filter?
Not at this point.
Okay.
If filtering occurs, it occurs before bottling.
Got you.
So at this point, you know, the bottle is ready to be shipped, but it needs, you know, disgorgement and dosage. Disgorgement is a traumatic
flying everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. It's
physical.
A traumatic action, you know, for the wine. The dosage also needs time to integrate into the wine and harmonize. So at this point, the wine needs to be aged for at least a short time, and preferably a little longer time. This is also something that we haven't historically paid enough attention to is post-disgorgement aging. You know, we talk about, in champagne, we talk a lot about lees aging, but we don't talk about aging after disgorgement.
Right.
And champagne, in fact, not only ages very well, but it actually needs time after disgorgement to really show its best.
I know. I think it was Paillard or somebody started listing the...
very early on, in the
80s. Disgorgement, post-disgorgement and all of that. Mm-hmm. So that's champagne. So like any wine, like Brunello has to stay, you know, in the barrels and the bottles for a certain amount of years before it's released. The better champagne makers will...
Yeah, so the minimum aging for non-vintage champagne is 15 months. Minimum for a vintage champagne is 3 years. In practice, the better producers age their wines for much longer than that. But there are rules.
Right. All right, so the prevailing theme in the book that I picked up, and I know I'm right on this and you'll agree with me, is terroir or place. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking about it a lot, you know, with vineyard locations and all that. Mm-hmm. Champaign's a pretty vast area, and you alluded to the fact that there's a lot of different, you know, areas and all that. One thing I kept picking up on is chalk, 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 chalk.
Yeah, yeah.
But the terroir is so important to Champaign. Tell me why terroir for Champaign is so important. It took up a lot of the book.
Sure, sure. So, you know, I mean, this goes back to, you know, this idea of treating Champagne as a real wine and right. asking the same questions of Champagne as we would of other wines and dealing with the same issues. For me, just, you know, when I think about fine wine and what is the purpose of fine wine, what is the interest of fine wine, it's about expressing the place that it was grown in. Right. So for me, terroir is fundamental to if a wine doesn't express, you know, if a wine doesn't tell me anything about where it's grown, then it's a manufactured product.
It could be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, it can be delicious, but I mean, orange juice can be delicious.
Right.
You know, it's like, why do we pay hundreds of dollars for, you know, particular bottles of wine?
Right.
And so, you know, Champagne is. A terroir expressive wine, like any other, you know, we've sort of forgotten about that because we tend to think of terroir as only single vineyard wines, only in terms of single vineyard wines, which I think is incorrect.
There's a diversity of terroir
in. Sure, and I think that blends. I think that terroir definitely plays a role in blends. But so because Champagne has been a blended wine, you know, we don't talk about terroir as much. And then also because Champagne has been so focused on brand, we don't talk about the vineyards.
So this is part of the transformation.
Absolutely.
How terroir is being expressed, discussed.
Absolutely.
You know, vinified and
yeah.
all that.
I mean, Champagne is a huge place. It covers 34,000 hectares of vineyard land, and that's a lot. And,
can you give me a perspective? Like, if you look at Burgundy or Bordeaux or parts of the Rhone, is it bigger, the same?
So,
I should know the answer.
Well, but. No, I mean, Champagne is vast. So, like for example, so Epernay is about an hour and a half drive from Paris,
right?
If you go east of Paris. But the vineyards... The vineyards of Champagne stretch more than halfway.
Really?
So the westernmost vineyards of Champagne are actually closer to Paris than to Epernay. In the north, it goes up to Reims, that's sort of the northern boundary. But then in the south, it goes all the way down to Chablis. So from my house in Epernay to get down to the southernmost vineyards of Champagne, that's a good two-hour drive.
Wow.
And so when you think about that kind of scale... You know, clearly terroir is going to differ over.
Well,
over
a
the
Chardonnay
region.
Grape closer to Chablis has
sure.
to taste a
has
lot different,
absolutely.
Than as you go north.
Yeah.
You know, towards Epernay, and I that's mean, the vastness
necessarily,
and that's the terroir. The terroir itself, is it predominantly chalk, or there's a handful of? I know different areas
sure.
concentrate.
The majority of Champagne lies on a very on a bedrock of chalk, specifically Cretaceous chalk, and a lot of the differences in, you know, between sites or, you know, areas or villages or individual vineyards, a lot of the differences lie in the topsoil. So the depth of the topsoil or what the topsoil is composed of, you know, what lies above that chalky bedrock.
Right.
In the eastern part and southern part of Champagne, it's actually not chalk. Here you have a much older soil, and here down in the Aube, in the Côte d'Ivoire, you have Kimmeridgian, which is the exact same soil type as Chablis. So this is an older,
right.
older geological, you know, formation from the Jurassic period, and that creates a whole different sort of wine. In the western part of Champagne, the chalky bedrock descends pretty far below the surface. So in the very western part of the Vallée de la Marne, you're no longer talking about chalk. You're talking about different limestones and clays and other things that are going on. You know,
you're
on
beyond
the
chalk is what you're saying?
Yeah, because the chalk is too far below the
right.
surface. But in the heart of Champagne, you know, for the majority of Champagne, yeah, you're really talking about this bedrock of solid chalk.
And is there something about chalk that imposes flavor or taste to Champagne? I mean, is that
so.
A characteristic you're going to pick up in a Champagne wine
yes.
because of the chalk versus
yes. I believe. You know, this is a big debate today about the whole idea of minerality and there are people who are really bent on demonstrating that actual minerals don't get transferred into
a
vine. And
people have to use the word minerality as a descriptor.
And so therefore, what minerality does that mean? Doesn't exist.
You're right.
But the thing is, that when you taste, let's say, in Champagne, when you taste a Chardonnay that's grown on chalk versus a Chardonnay that's grown on sand versus a Chardonnay that's grown on clay, these all taste very, very different.
Right.
And they taste consistently different and identifiably different.
Right.
So, for me, I think that chalk, really does bring a very distinctive character.
I'm sure. We have to take a quick break. We're talking to Peter Leem. Peter's new book, Champagne, is out. It's available everywhere, Amazon, bookstores. When we come back, I want to ask Peter a couple more quick questions. I want to subject him to our wine list. We're going to do a special Champagne version. I'm sure Peter can give us some great recos. And then hopefully we'll have time. We're sipping a Champagne right now. We'll talk about it. You're listening to The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
We're back. We're back with my guest, Peter Leem. Peter's new book, Champagne, is out right now. We're talking about it. Before I subject Peter to our wine list, I wanted to ask him the best way to drink champagne. I'm interested in glassware. I'm interested in temperature. Mm-hmm. I'm interested when you look at it, what a big, small bubbles mean, what's good. Yeah. How do you evaluate it? I mean, give me a quick primer on, let's do it right.
Well, first of all, I think champagne is the only wine in the world that can be consumed at any time of the day or night.
Agree.
That's pretty marvelous on its own. I think we as consumers, and also as sommeliers and tradespeople, people or service people, we're recognizing that. That champagne can be treated as a real wine. And so, for example, glassware. This is a huge, huge topic of discussion right now among both consumers, abroad and also, champenois in the region. For most of the 20th century, champagne was served in flutes, which is great visually, but it doesn't do many favors to the wine itself. It's much better to serve champagne in a tulip glass or a white wine glass.
The bigger opening on the top allows you to appreciate the wine and for it to open.
Sure. You wouldn't serve white Burgundy in a flute.
No.
So, why would you serve champagne in a flute?
Old tradition that didn't make sense.
Sure. Oftentimes, even today, oftentimes champagne is served way too cold.
Refrigerate it.
Well, you can. You do need to refrigerate it.
But let it sit.
But treat it like a white wine. I think that not just with champagne, but with wine in general, the more complex the wine, the less you need to chill it. Right.
Right.
So Burgundy if I'm drinking a really simple, you know, like Bourgogne Blanc, you know, yeah, serving a little colder, you know, with a plate of oysters, like that's great.
Less nuances than an older fan.
If I'm drinking a Chevalier Monarchie, or you know, then I'm not going to serve it, you know, out of the freezer.
Right.
I want to taste the complexity of the wine.
So cold, not cold.
Yeah, it's chilled. The same with champagne.
Think about it as a, you know, as a. I don't mind it as room temperature, at room temperature, because I think a lot of the qualities come out.
Yeah, in fact, I'm the same way. You know, I'm the guy who like leaves his champagne glass there through dinner, and you know, right. at the end, like the wine's warm, and yeah, you know, you don't see any bubbles anymore, but it's delicious.
When you look at the bubbles, is there any significance to a lot of bubbles, a little bubbles, big bubbles, small bubbles? I know it varies.
I mean. You know, we prefer small bubbles.
Small bubbles, okay.
What's funny is that, there are people doing a lot of research into bubbles, but we don't actually know why, like, bubbles are small.
Okay. So there's no art to making it bigger or small.
Well, people have said a lot of things, you know, in the past in champagne, but you know, yes, we prefer smaller bubbles.
Okay.
Younger champagnes tend to have more bubbles than older ones, right?
Right, but that tames down in time, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And what's happening today is that champagnes are overall being released younger, so there are more younger champagnes on the market than there were in the past.
Right.
So we tend to see champagnes with a lot of effervescence. We've grown used to that.
Right.
Sometimes I think there's maybe too much, you know, and
effervescence. Yeah, too many bubbles.
Yes, you know, when you open a bottle of champagne, it's really frothy. You know, there are lots of bubbles, and you let it calm down a little bit, even just 10 or 15 minutes, and you know, the bubbles calm down, and you get a lot more of the wine. You know, and
so don't be in such a rush when you drink it. And if you're smart, buy younger champagnes. Be patient. Put them away for a few years.
In the cellar. Absolutely.
You know, once you build it up, you can go grab. All right, so. Regular wine glass, not cold, and chill to it. Let it open up and sit in the glass a little.
You know, treat it like you would any other wine.
Small bubbles are good. All right, that's good advice. I want everyone to abide by that, and you'll enjoy your champagne much more. All right, Peter, we do this thing called the wine list. We ask our guests a bunch of questions. It's called the wine list. This is going to be the wine list special champagne edition. Mm-hmm. Peter Leem. All right, so the first question is the same question we ask everybody. What are you drinking now? It could be champagne. What champagnes? Are you tasting a region, a style? Are there wines on your table right now that you're tasting more than others?
Well, I think what I really like about champagne is its diversity. And we have a more diverse picture of champagne today than ever before. And so that's really exciting to explore. You know, we're seeing new growers in the marketplace every day. You know, there are new terroirs to explore. There are people making.
So you're seeking out all these new opportunities.
I am. So you know, trying to taste across the region, trying to explore the region through very site specific wines. But also, it's not just that. You know, I mean, that's only a portion of what champagne is. I think that blended champagnes, and especially champagnes from well known houses, from high quality houses, are better today than they ever have been.
They got their game up too.
And so these are also really exciting to taste as well.
Okay, all right. Next question is usually favorite wine and food pairing. Give me your favorite champagne and food pairing. Now, we have a rule on the Grape Nation. Yeah. Favorite wine and food pairing, you're not allowed to say champagne and oysters. Okay? You can say that, but then what after that?
Well,
is there something you've discovered, you matched, or something, you know, you yearn for? Give me the Peter Leem champagne and food pairing that you go back to.
Well, I think that one thing. This relates to the diversity of champagne, and so champagne.
Good point.
Is so much
it's
more stylistically diverse than we as consumers give it credit for.
You make me feel bad. It's a silly question.
It's not a silly question
okay.
though. Because but so Well, one, champagne is extremely versatile as a food wine, right?
Yes.
Because of its low alcohol,
that's
because of its
a
high
major
acidity,
thing to be known.
Because of its effervescence. But then also you add on like the diversity of the wines available in the region, and then you have this huge palette from which to work, you know, and to pair, you know, champagne and food. But you know, there are certain things that champagne does very well at.
Give me a favorite
like
of yours.
Anything umami.
Okay.
So, like, you know, mushrooms, Japanese food, anything that is on the umami spectrum, you know, champagne has a natural affinity with.
You're the first person who ever said that. You know, there's champagne oysters, champagne mm-hmm. fried chicken. People think it's good with pizza.
And why does champagne go with oysters? Because oysters are so briny and they're
right,
so umami.
The salinity.
Yeah. With anything fried, champagne really excels.
Fried chicken
so
is
fried
a great.
Fried chicken and champagne is one of the great, food pairings of the wine world.
David Chang does fried chicken, caviar, and champagne.
There you go.
Not a bad
there you
deal.
Go. Yeah. Yeah, it's...
All right, so that's a good one. You don't have to go any further. Tell me, we ask people their favorite wine restaurant and or bar with special attention towards wine. Tell me your favorite wine restaurant or bar with special attention to champagne that you know you can go in, there's a selection, they're knowledgeable.
Yeah.
Give me some place in the States, New York.
Yeah. I mean, in New York, we're blessed with this. You know, as far as great champagne lists.
It's become a Somme favorite.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, I love going to places like Terroir, you know, where you know, you can always find excellent champagne to drink.
Paul and Sabre do a great job.
Absolutely.
With that.
You know, restaurants like Maialino and Marta, you know,
have built the lists up.
Really, yeah, who have really special champagne lists and sell them, you know, very fair prices.
Yep.
You know, now Ariel has opened Ayers Champagne Parlor.
Yes.
You know, New York is a very exciting place to drink champagne.
And, so there's no lack of people that focus seriously on it.
Yeah. You know, historically, I think more people focus on champagne outside the Champagne region, you know, than inside.
Right.
But actually, so, you know, historically, there weren't always so many good places to drink champagne in Champagne.
That's gotten better.
Yeah, but okay. I think you know now today, if you go to Reims, or if you come and visit Champagne, then you know you have places like La Wine Bar, which, despite the terrible name, they have an amazing wine list. Of you know, there are places like the Glue Pot, you know, and of course the very best place in the world to drink champagne, you know, has to be Le Crayer, which is
spell one, please.
Crayer is Crayers.
Okay.
It's one of the fanciest restaurants in Champagne. It's one of the best. But they have a legendary sommelier there, Philippe Jeunesse.
So that's a special
And
place.
He has put together an incredible champagne list.
Okay. All right, Peter, we have less than 5 minutes to get everything done. So we have two more questions, and then let's quickly taste some wine. Do you have a favorite all-time champagne? Could you narrow it down to one or two?
I don't.
You don't? Okay.
I can't do that.
I didn't think you could, but... Either, obviously, this is a dumb statement. Either you do or you don't, and I understand why you don't.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I mentioned this to you earlier before we were on air. Give me a couple of great value champagnes that are accessible, that are reasonably priced, and are delicious.
Yeah.
Specific, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, there are certainly brands that, you know, that are you know very available that are really excellent you know like some non-vintage champagnes that I really like right now for example Ruinart Blanc de Blanc you know for a delicate fresh lively champagne you know I mean this is excellent. Charles Heidsieck is you know on a richer more complex side of things but an incredible value you know for what it is.
Give me one more. So two different styles already.
Yeah,
give me a third style or.
Well, you know, so these are wines that are blended from you know from you know, larger number of places.
Right.
If you wanted to drill down more, you know, and get more like tightly regional champagnes, you know, some non-vintage champagnes from grower estates that I think are particularly great value are things like Charton Taillé, Berrèche. Pierre Peters, Villemar. So
I will post all of those
there
on the
are,
site.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are. I mean, champagne is necessarily a little more expensive than other wines because of how it's made
and
aged.
But we're looking for the value.
Yeah, when you're talking about value, there's a lot to be found right now.
Right. All right, so those are good choices. I'll post those. All right, we're going to wrap up. Every week we taste a different wine on air. For our weekly wine sip this week, we're going to taste the Jacquesin 739 Extra Brut Champagne Non-Vintage. I think it's from Famille Chiquet.
Yeah, it's the Chiquet family, who are the owners.
The wine currently retails for about $50, available at better wine stores. Quickly tell me a little more about the wine. I'm going to pour myself some.
So this is a really, this embodies a lot of the contemporary era in Champagne. You know, going back to speaking about Champagne as a real wine, you know, so historically, non-vintage blends in Champagne were, or at least conventional wisdom says that they were made to be consistent from one year to the next. So whenever you're buying the brand that you like, it's always going to be the same. What Jacquesin is doing is throwing that whole idea out the window. And so each new release has a new number. So this is 739. Next year is 40. Next year is 41.
No house style there. Everything
and what their idea is not to make a consistent blend from year to year, but to make the best possible blend that they can. So this one happens to be heavy on Chardonnay. It's like 57% Chardonnay.
57, 21, 22 on the Meunier.
But maybe next year it'll be Pinot Noir dominant, or you know, it depends on the vintage.
And it was made in 2011, which was this not a based, great year yeah. in Champagne.
So this is based on 2011, but it has a healthy amount of reserve wine.
Right, you know, 37%.
Yeah,
I did a little research.
Yeah, so really the object of this cuvée is to make the very best blend that they possibly can,
right,
regardless
so
of style.
Let's give it a quick taste. So color, you have kind of that light yellow straw.
Yeah, so Jacquesin is famous for fermenting all of their wines in wood. In very large oak casks, and that gives the wine a little bit of color.
Go on the nose.
On both the nose and palate, I think there's a certain richness, and that's very typical of Jacquesin's wines as well.
I get a little citrus, lemon. I get a little
I think here because of the high predominance of Chardonnay, you get more of those. You know, more of those things
yeah.
than you might in another version of Jacquesin's.
Give me
wine.
Mouthfeel.
So this wine, even though it's very lively, it has you know has plenty of acidity, it has a very lively structure, it's still quite rich in texture.
Yeah.
And you know, part of that is from the fermentation in oak. Part of that is simply selecting you know very very ripe wines, low yielding wines, but that's also a hallmark of the Jacquesin style
right.
is this plushness of texture
and a couple of descriptors on the palate.
I think you see the effects of lees aging, right? So you get this yeastiness,
right?
But it's
brioche
it's,
bread yeah. or yeast or something.
But it's very much in balance. You know, it plays a supporting role. To the fruit and to other non-fruit elements in the wine, it doesn't overpower the wine,
right?
And I think that's something that I really like.
Right, I agree with that. Do we like this wine?
I like it a lot.
This is a good wine for around $45-$50.
I think so.
Okay, and Jacquesin, like you said, each year $739, they'll do a 40. There's past ones. They'll
yeah.
do the best.
Yeah.
With what's going on that year. Classic pairings as a sparkling champagne or
yeah, I mean, you know, you could do this with a lot of different things, but I think being on the richer side of the spectrum, you know, I think that this wine has the body and the depth to pair more with like you know, with richer foods, like
right.
more white meats, more fish. You know, rather than like oysters or canapés.
Right.
Or,
good know. To know. All right, Peter, we're running out of time. We got to wrap up. I want to thank you for coming on. If you have a question, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. I will post Peter's wine list answers, and there were some good ones in there. I will list the wine we drank, the Jacquesin, our weekly wine sip. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and Twitter at BenRuby. Peter, your book is available, I'm assuming, on Amazon.
It is.
Just click and buy.
Yes. Anywhere books are
and
sold.
And anywhere books are sold, better bookstores. If people would like to follow Peter Leem on social media, they could follow you where?
I'm on Twitter, at Peter Leem.
P-E-T-E-R-L-I-E-M.
Yes. And Instagram.
Same thing.
Same handle.
Okay. And we didn't talk about it a lot, but your champagne website is champagneguide, one word.
Champagneguide.net.
And that's a subscriber-based thing?
It's a subscription site.
Okay, yes. Worth every penny if champagne is something that's your interest, your wheelhouse, or you want to know more. So champagneguide.net. Thank you, Peter, for coming in during this busy time. Good time of the year. I don't like to make champagne a celebratory thing, but we're all celebrating.
Still, we're all
thinking
about
that.
Champagne now.
Thank you to our engineer. We have David sitting in today. And thank you to everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.